I was thinking the other day about how the cat must, like, I was playing with Mean Cat down there,
mm-hmm.
and then Nico, like, snuck up behind her and was above her, also, like, watching the playing action.
Like, on a furniture?
Yeah, on top of a furniture.
Uh-huh.
And she did it so quietly, and Scout Hat didn't notice, like, as she was crawling up, you know, like, Scout was engaged batting at, you know, the
mm-hmm.
piece of t-shirt. And then, like, as Nico was sitting there very silently behind her and probably, like, you know, a foot behind her and 2 feet up,
mm-hmm.
suddenly Scout, you know, turns around and goes, oh! And
mm-hmm.
I just thought about how, like, for the cats with those giant radar dishes on top of their heads, they must hear things from so far away, like heartbeats, breathing,
mm-hmm.
you know? They,
mm-hmm.
like, probably when they walk into a room, they can hear a heartbeat, I would imagine, especially
they
if it's a quiet room.
They definitely react to sounds in other parts of the house that I can't really hear.
Totally. And that's, you know, they talk about, like, oh, cat staring at a wall, whatever. Well, there's probably a bug in that wall or a mouse or something.
Mm-hmm.
That, like,
or a ghost, most likely.
Mm-hmm. But, like, a ghost that's so quiet that we can't hear it, you know?
Right.
It's just going like, very quietly go, ooh, ooh. But it's such a low, like, possibly, you know, ultrasonic level.
So that's why we have to take room tone even when it's really quiet in here.
Yeah.
Is
because
for the ghost, the
if there's any,
ghost sounds.
If there's any, if we have any cat listeners,
uh-huh.
they're going to want us to filter out all of the low boos from the ghosts.
I assume we have cat listeners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, based on our relationship with cats, I assume that we would have, like, some pretty, you know, loyal cat fans.
Oh, yeah, we've got cat fans.
We definitely have cat fans in this house, especially around dinner time.
Mm-hmm.
They're our biggest fans.
Yeah, they get real interested in the podcast around dinner time.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, meow, meow, let me listen to the podcast. And we're like, okay,
mm-hmm.
but you have to eat your food first. And they're like, well, okay. And then they go and eat their food that we put down for them. And then we turn on the podcast and they just, like, sit in the general vicinity and fall asleep to it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really soothing for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very nice.
Just like Scout right now. She's, like, enjoying listening to us record the podcast because it's, like, her, you know, everybody has their, like, fall asleep television show.
Mm-hmm.
This is, like, her fall asleep television show.
Well, I figure, like, this is really exciting for her to be in on the live podcast recording.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's kind of like when How Did This Get Made came to Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I went and saw it with my friend and it was, like, all that much better to be there live. Even though the live versions of that particular podcast aren't my favorite. It's really fun to go.
Yeah.
And see
I imagine
live.
The live version is better if you're actually there.
Mm.
Because I feel like one of the things I don't like about the live episodes of that podcast is they do actually reference a lot of stuff that you as a listener can't see.
Yeah, they do. Because
yeah.
they have a lot of visual aids. They,
yeah.
you know, Paul Scheer has, like, got his laptop on stage the whole time and he's putting stuff up on a big
mm-hmm,
screen, you know,
mm-hmm.
and, like, he has the whole movie that he's, like, scrubbing through and, like, showing particular parts of the movie that, like, he's thought about or that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He's quite you know, he's quite tech savvy. I'd say, you know, it can be tricky once you're on stage as a guy who's been in control of, like, the screen on stage.
Mm-hmm.
To be good with those tools and, like, quick on the draw is impressive.
Do you ever think of yourself as a Paul Scheer type?
I mean, just because I'm interested in comedy and I'm bald and I kind of tend to do research on things and
I like bad movies.
And I like bad movies.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, maybe.
I think of you as a Paul Scheer type.
But
also because I think of myself as a June Diane Raphael type.
Oh, you're a total June Diane type.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah. Right down to
because I'm super hot
mm-hmm.
and I want you to run for office if you're a lady.
Yeah, because you're not shy of showing a little side boob every once in a while.
When do I show side boob?
Dude, at the Bastion or at the secret swimming place that we've been
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
where we can do socially distant swimming.
Mm-hmm.
There you had side boob. Yesterday.
I did?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know. That's fun.
Mm-hmm.
I can't feel it. Like, I don't have my side boob sense isn't calibrated.
It's not tingling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe you don't have enough, like, tiny little peach fuzz hairs on the side of your boobs to, like, tell
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
I think, you know, you raise a good point.
Is it like boob whiskers? Like a cat has whiskers and they can tell.
I could think about getting some more peach fuzz hair installed on my boobs.
Yeah, just the sides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe the bottom, too.
Yeah?
So I know when I'm showing bottom boob.
Yeah, that's probably a good thing. Because you're always wearing those halter tops.
I think I'll get, like, just some good clumps of hair installed right around the nipples. Is that...
Yeah, that's...
Because I want those to really... I want to really know if those are showing.
Yeah, well, the nipples are kind of like... They have been called the eyes of the boobs. And in that, they are the major sensory organ of the boob. Mm-hmm. And so to supplement that with, like, hair...
Mm-hmm. And the boobs have been called the windows to the soul, I've
yes.
heard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right.
And that's why I'm always like, my boobs are down here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that in the film Cars, they made the headlights of the cars the eyes of the cars, when I've always thought of those as the boobs of the cars.
What do you think of as the eyes?
The windshield.
Oh, like it's just wearing a big, like, sunglasses, like one of those visors from Star Trek.
Oh, wait, do I have that wrong? And on Cars, the windshield is the eyes. And I'm thinking of the old Chevron with Techron commercials, like the Aardman commercials, where the cars were claymation and they had eyes.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Because the engine area, what do you call that? The frontis part.
Yeah, the frontis piece.
Yeah, that does seem like the nose of the car, for sure.
Mm-hmm. More so on some cars than on others.
Yeah. And some cars have more of a smiley bumper than others.
Yeah, some cars have an angry bumper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Ugh, like in, The Brave Little Toaster. Some of those cars were really angry looking.
I never saw The Brave Little Toaster.
Oh, yeah. I keep forgetting that, and it's, like, insane to me. We need to watch that.
I remember it was a thing that came out, and I feel like it wasn't in theaters very long, but I remember Blockbuster promoting it a lot when they had it.
I mean,
video.
I watched it a ton when I was a kid.
I think
you gotta watch it.
I think I was a snob for, like, it needed to be, like, a big Disney hit for me to want to see.
That
there needed
sounds
to be,
so typical of you.
There needed to be some hype for this.
You're
children's
like,
movie.
Uh-huh, I'm so sad there's no summer Blockbusters this summer. And
yeah.
I was like, ugh, that's like the thing I least want to see.
I love, I mean, you know that I get, back when MoviePass was a thing, that was a real summer of Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the Blockbuster potential and me having MoviePass and just going to see all of the Blockbusters. And
I will say this.
Even some that were just like, that weren't Blockbusters but were like block irritators.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Block ticklers?
Yeah, block ticklers.
Uh-huh. I will say this. A movie theater is a nice air-conditioned place to be in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, we've definitely been noting with coronavirus, like, how we note the absence of air-conditioned indoor spaces to just, like, hang out other than our house.
I mean, when I was, like, walking dogs in Manhattan and, you know, I was making my own hours, some of those hours would be devoted in the hottest part of the day to just going to a damn movie.
Mm-hmm.
And with MoviePass, you could do that. And then I switched over to AMC Pass, which was also good.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem, of course, was that I lived in Brooklyn and they didn't have any AMC movie theaters in Brooklyn.
There's no AMC movie theaters around here either. So
no.
I think that.
But all of these theater companies could be kaputs by the time coronavirus is over and we can actually go back to them. But I was interested in getting a Regal Cinema Pass, which is the same thing, but for Regal Cinemas, which they do have those in Brooklyn.
I think they
and
have
I don't know
those.
What the, but
oh,
we need
no,
a we
Cinemark.
Need Cinemark.
Yeah, Cinemark.
We need Cinemark because
here.
You got the Rave and you got the my favorite place in the world. You know the
one in Hadley.
The Hadley Mall.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Hadley Mall, a teenage boy or teenage boy enthusiast.
Yes.
That's not what I mean.
No.
You're not an enthusiast.
I'm not a teenage boy enthusiast. I am an enthusiast of activities that teenage boys would typically like to do because that is my emotional level of maturity, not because I am interested in interacting.
Don't go telling everyone in the whole world that... I'm in love with you and you have the emotional maturity of a teenage boy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I call it like I see it. But
I don't think you have the emotional maturity of a teenage boy.
Here's the things that
you've never told me I'm not your mom.
No, but I've accidentally called you my mom.
No, I don't think
no,
so.
No, I just accidentally called you my ex-girlfriend's
name.
Yeah,
that definitely happens.
Yeah. Not very much, though.
Not that much.
Although my... I told you about how my dad called his step... Or my stepmother my mother's name.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been together for, like, 17 years.
Mm-hmm. Right. It'll happen. Like, oof. Well, apparently my dad calls his dog my name. So,
oh, yeah,
you
I saw
know.
That. Yeah.
These things happen.
My dad has several times in my life called me my uncle's name because my dad had, like, my uncle is like 5 or 6 years younger than my dad, so he was like the little brother.
Yeah.
And so it's just that thing,
right.
Especially men especially have only so many, like, slots for important people in their lives.
Yeah.
And
well, and I think it's just
they tend
like
to slot them in and out.
I think it's a really, like, basic principle of neurons firing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're annoyed or you feel affection or, you know, whatever it might be in that particular moment, it's really easy for the wrong, like, synapses to fire at each other,
totally.
Right?
Totally.
So.
Which is all very important to what we're going to be talking about today, which is Dune. I want to say chapter 30.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to
and
look that up.
You have said save it for the podcast more this week
so
than
this
any
week.
Other
yes.
week since we've
I
been
definitely
doing
want
it.
To talk. I want to expand
so
upon.
So you better have some good stuff.
What we talked about last time, because for the listeners may recall last episode.
That was a tough one.
Caitlin was incensed,
mm-hmm.
basically, and you know, please stop me if I'm getting this wrong because I want to accurately convey, you know, what you were feeling.
Okay.
Maybe I should just ask you to do that.
No, you go ahead. I'm curious.
But, like, tell me if I'm right, or tell me if I'm wrong, that basically you were incensed sort of... The central problem for you with Dune
mm-hmm.
is that there is no, like, mystery tension. There's no unexpectedness, no twistiness to the plot. Everything is being... sort of laid out, telegraphed, and then occurring shortly afterwards. So it's like,
yeah,
at no point do we think, oh, you know, the Atreides are going to move to Arrakis and just have a great time and be very successful.
Right.
At all times we know, because the second chapter,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was the Harkonnen, like, meeting,
mm-hmm.
where they said, here's what we're going to do to the Atreides and here's why, and then that happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let me just say, because, like...
And you want more... You want more unexpected things to happen. You want more spontaneity. You want to be...
Yes. And that's just given the type of story that this is, because you were like, oh, that... Your favorite book, The Moviegoer, does that have, like, tension in it? And, like, there's not tension in the sense that there's, like, some kind of big twist or mystery to solve or anything like that. It's just, like... It's not always, like... Yeah, everything isn't, like, foreshadowed to death,
mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
like, you're just not always sure. You're like, what is, like, the point of this thing that's happening right now? Like, what is this leading to?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is there... It builds some, like, just intellectual tension and, like...
For the listener, she has picked up a book that she has been reading,
yes,
and I think she might be about to talk about...
This is my pleasure reading when I don't have to read Dune right
uh-huh.
now.
It's a Pulitzer Prize winner. It says right there on the
Yeah, I think
cover.
It's the author. I don't know if it's the book or the author who's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, but it's Jhumpa Lahiri who wrote The Namesake, which was turned into a very well-received movie.
Yeah.
And
what was that one about? I recall the
I don't know. I rely on
Namesake.
You to remember
Wait
what
a minute. Was it the
about.
Movie? Was that the one? Did you read it? Was The Namesake the one where the guy's name was Gogol and it was Kumar from Harold and Kumar?
Yeah.
And he was named after the writer Gogol.
Yes. And I've seen the movie many, many years ago. I don't super remember what it's
about. I saw the movie. I was not crazy
about it. I do
remember
enjoying the movie.
I wasn't crazy about the movie.
Okay.
I thought his character
was kind
of a dick.
Wasn't enough of a summer blockbuster.
But as I recall, it was a cool... The cool conceit of the movie was it was sort of contrasting Gogol
mm-hmm.
Kumar from Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. His name is, I can't remember, but I know he worked for the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
His deal was that, like, you know, he was going to going through life and going to, you know, a private university and, like, meeting shitty people, as you do. in life when you're young. And but it was contrasting with like his father and his mother at the same age coming to coming to America from India for the first time, and like all the things they went to through. And
well, it's good we're having this conversation, because reading this book, which is called The Interpreter of Maladies, is actually a series of short stories by Jhumpa Lahiri, is making me like want to watch The Namesake again, and like you just sort of reminding me what that movie's about. So anyway, but I just was thinking about, you know, because like short stories, right, there's not a lot of opportunity to like build a lot of tension or mystery or whatever, but there is like each and every single one of these stories just creates this sort of tension for the reader of like, I'm just not super sure like why anything in this story is happening right now. And I guess once I get to the end, I'll have seen why everything happened.
Yeah. So it's sort of like it's starting in random, seemingly random directions and giving you stuff. And you're like, how's the pleasure is partly in how's all this stuff going to come together in the end? And then it all comes together in the end. And you're like,
Or it doesn't really come together. And it's just sort of like the entire time I'm just sort of like, well, this is like well written. It's like written in a format that that like works for me. Like the writing style works for me. And like, I'm just not quite sure why I am being told this story. And I get to spend the whole time like wondering that.
Yeah, totally. So I wanted to talk, I've been thinking about this, and so that's the sort of pleasure you're getting from that, I think is not being focused, that sort of pleasure is not being focused on in Dune for, but as you see, it's still, people like it, it's still successful, because I think that what Dune is doing is a very characteristically science fiction style, and let me, and you know, let me, hear me out on this, which is basically the what a science fiction enthusiast a lot of times, including me, is definitely looking for in a book, in a science fiction book, is often sort of like David X. Cohen, producer of Futurama, characterized it in his typically mathematical way of saying like this book has great ideas per page, like density, and that is what I think, that's what I often get fired up about, is like there's if there are a lot of different ideas that are sort of something that is looking at something in a way I've never looked at it before, or in a, you know, a novel, like a novel idea for a new technology, or how, or the implications of some technology out in the future, and some implication,
some kind of ecosystem you've never seen before.
And how it works.
Some kind of political system that
exploring a different kind of political system. Exploring just kind of like parts and pieces. The different parts and pieces are what are ultimately enjoyable in a lot of ways in these books.
What I interpret from that
I also wanted to give you. Can I give you another like? Another huge like classic science fiction. One of the one of the other most popular like and most well regarded science fictions, and actually I believe one like the when I want to say when the Hugo Awards first started getting going, which happened in like the late 60s or early 70s, something like that. Two of the first books they honored, and this is, you know, I might be getting this wrong, and they sort of honored them together as like these are the greatest works of science fiction that weren't around before, you know, until that weren't around when the Hugos or that were predated the Hugos, like so the first time we're going to give these honorary awards, and the two books they gave this maybe three books they gave honorary awards were two were Dune, Lord of the Rings, and a book called, and I might be getting all this wrong, but it's close enough to be like feel like the truth. The other one was the Foundation series by Isaac Asimov. And here is the central conceit of the Foundation series. It was written before Dune, by the way. There is a galaxy-wide empire. All the planets of humanity, all the planets you know that can be inhabited have basically been inhabited all throughout the galaxy by humans. Right? There's a central government. And because there are so many people, like to talk about, you know, like planetary, you can talk about, look at people and like, you know, the billions and trillions, like across, like you can look at them in units of like dozens of planets at a time kind mm-hmm. of thing. The numbers of people are so large that you can, that there can, there arises a new science that's kind of like called psychohistory, which is, you know, kind of taking all of psychology and sociology and making predictions about, and making very solid predictions about what those societies are going to do in the future.
Can you get to the point? You've been talking for so long.
Sorry.
And I wanted to say something.
Okay.
And you're like, no, I have a more important thing to say. But so just say it.
Okay. The point is they, the whole conceit of these books is, this guy predicts that the empire is going to fall, and he lays out these two, you know, this society that's going to carry the nucleus of like technology forward into the future. So instead of this being a 10,000 year long dark age at the end of
who cares? What? Why is this
empire.
Important? What is the point? What are you trying to say?
The point is, and you're being mean. The point is that the entire conceit of the book is that this guy made this prediction and laid out how things are going to happen,
uh-huh.
and they are going to happen that way.
Uh-huh.
And you're reading how things happen in exactly the way the guy said it was going to happen over the course of 1,000 years.
That sounds incredibly boring.
But it is one of the most successful, and that's what happens in the books basically. And
mm-hmm.
it's one of the most successful, best loved science fiction tales of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of the pleasure in science fiction, I think, is a bit in the explanation of like, I have an idea and we are going to really explore exactly how this idea plays out.
I understand that. And like, there are times that I think that that's an interesting conceit.
I'm not saying you have to like that. I'm saying I think that is the
But
appeal.
I'm saying that sometimes I do like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, for example, like some of those, you know, baby sci-fi books you read in like high school, like Brave New World or whatever, right?
Why like, I said a baby sci-fi book.
Well, because it's like, you know, sci-fi book that's like required high school reading.
Mm. Like Fahrenheit 451.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Like those books, that's basically what they're doing. They're like, okay, like let's imagine the world is like this,
mm-hmm.
and like what happens when the world is like this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you can do that and still like build some like intrigue over
mm-hmm.
the course of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I feel like what you said to me that I was gonna react to, like, oh my
Sorry.
God, I think it was like 30 minutes ago.
We haven't even been recording that long, so get off my ass about that, okay? It's not that I was talking for a long time, it's just that you were bored by it.
Yeah, same thing. Anyway, so is that what you're saying is like the joy or the pleasure for you is in like getting to know the world?
Or exploring the ideas that he's presenting in the world.
Sure, and I get why that's interesting. Like, at the same time that in this particular world, like, to me, there's nothing, like, eerie enough to, like, be that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in, like, I haven't read Brave New World in, like, a million years, so I'm maybe totally talking out my ass or whatever. But I do think, like, sometimes in these books, they're, like, building worlds where it's, like, ooh, I'm, like, this whole situation is, like, making me a little bit uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I like that feeling of, like, discomfort. And, like, you're saying, like, oh, I like the feeling of just sort of, like, exploring the material universe that this person is, like, creating.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I don't really like that because, you know me, I'm interested in the emotional universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every time this book becomes about the emotional universe, I'm interested in it. Even like the chapter we just read that was about like the ecology of the planet, I found interesting.
Mm.
But like, it's like the material universe. I'm like, whatever. Like, I don't know. Like, how is this affecting people, like, and the way that people relate to each other, and like the society that's being created, you know, around it. And I think there's been some of that in this book, but like, there just hasn't really been that many points where I've sort of been like, to me, the interesting thing about sort of looking into the future, or like having this like futuristic view of humanity, is like being a little like perturbed by it. Like, oh, like, is this where we're headed? And like, what is that going to feel like to like be a person in that, world, you know? But that's more like futurism, which isn't always, you know, the same thing as sci-fi also. So anyway, I don't know. Yeah, it's just, there's just not enough there for me. That's all.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad we had that discussion. I'm glad we kind of got that, that out there, because I think I think in a lot of ways, for me, there are, you know, like you say, talking about the emotionality of it, I think that's something that Dune does do a lot better than a lot of other science fiction. You know, I think we really get into people's heads and into their motivations, and I think we'll talk about that with Liet Kynes here, as he's as he is having his travail in the desert, because that's very much what this is about. But I'm like, I totally get it, that it's so much of it is like not working for you on that level. So
yeah, well, and even with that, I don't know, you know, it's like, it does feel really hard to sometimes to put my finger on why I'm reading this book so begrudgingly.
What if it was like the same kind of thing, but it wasn't a desert, it was the ocean, it was an ocean planet. Same problem.
No, I don't care. Planet. That physical environment makes no difference to me. That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I don't give a shit about any of that. What I give a shit about is like, how is this life affecting the characters and the way that they relate to each other and the relationships that they have? And how does that look different from like the way that people relate to each other now? And, you know, even I think even if it was like first person, just first Paul. Person, like
just one perspective.
Yeah, just one perspective. I think I'd probably find that much more interesting, because I'd get to like dig really deep into how is that person emotionally experiencing this world, and how does that affect like the way that they're relating to other people, and like what is like what's going on in this world how does that affect their like emotional experience of it?
You bring up an interesting point about like how are these people reacting to their situation, and versus like how would we react like now, or how they would react to something. I think that I feel like maybe not the point of one of the points of the book, but like I think the an aspect of the book that I find interesting is that even though these people often have they have like superpowers and things, I think that I feel like they're kind of reacting in the way that we would react. I feel like they're
right, exactly.
Like if we were given the same shit they have, we would do the same stuff and think the same ways. Like yeah. I feel like that's
well, and like the last,
you know, this is a book about humans,
right?
Explicitly, and that's part of it, you know, and what it means to be human, and what you know. I think we still haven't quite solved the thesis of the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Monheim as like what's the difference between a human and an animal, like according to her, like what's that important difference, you know, waiting, you know, when we're trapped, we got a little paw on the trapped, and we're instead of chewing our arm off, we're gonna wait and attack the trapper to eliminate a threat to our kind, you know, as
there's like a lot of like big society principles going on here for sure, and you would think I'd be into that because I'm a sociologist, but
is the sociology just like so old hat, so outdated for you that like
Yeah, I guess so in a way. Like, and I think that there's like they keep so there's like references that are being made to like the power dynamic between like the ruling class and the Fremen. I think there's so much more potential for exploration there that I'd be really interested in. Like, think about like I'm just gonna start naming sci-fi things I've enjoyed because like this is how I'm gonna get to it, right?
Number one, Last Guns.
No. But like District 9, that movie, like I thought that movie was so fascinating for a number of reasons. Like one, I thought like I was really trying to think about it as a like an allegory for, you know, something like dynamics that are going on now, which was actually harder. And then my friend, okay, so if anybody hasn't seen District 9, basically like a bunch of aliens land in South Africa and are like imprisoned. And then like the entire movie is basically about like the power dynamics and social dynamics between like the human class and the alien class.
It's like they've set up this crazy apartheid or something.
Exactly,
But in
right?
South
So,
Africa this time.
right, no, exactly. So there's like that comparison that I thought was really interesting. And then my friend was like, oh yeah, well, I think of it more as like what would happen? Like, and I think that's a really interesting thing to think about too. Like, do human beings just have this tendency towards subjugation of like creatures we don't understand?
I'd say our track record points to
Yes,
yes.
right. So, you know, I feel like there's like I'd love to dig in more to like what that power relationship looks like with the Fremen. Like, I'd love to dig in more to like what like benefit the like Bene Gesserit philosophy has like to the school and like what I don't know, just like how does that affect the way that people experience and deal with the world? Like, I'm not saying that that hasn't been addressed at all, but I feel like I could go so much deeper with that. I'd
Well,
love
then I
to.
might have three or four books
Oh,
that he
God.
were published after subsequent to this one that you might be interested in.
But I'm also thinking about the last sci-fi novel I read before this was Parable of the Sower
Sower,
and
Octavia
Butler.
Butler.
And that novel was hard for me to get through for sure because I always just struggle through the world building. But once I got through the world building, like I think one of the things that was really interesting to me about that novel is that the main character, and it's written from her perspective, is basically trying to figure out, okay, now that like our way of life has been destroyed, like what tools, what emotional, like spiritual, psychological tools do we need to like think about how to build a new world? And that's a really interesting exploration for me because honestly, like, so we've been talking again and again about like, you know, the book you're gonna begrudgingly read being Emergent Strategy, and like you'll see in that book, like she takes a lot of inspiration from Octavia Butler in the way that she thinks about movement building, Adrienne Marie Brown, that is, because like, you know, she says like sci-fi is like, or you know, we're basically creating a world that doesn't exist yet. It's a lot like sci-fi. So all of the like there's a lot of like basic principles in sci-fi that have the potential to be really interesting to me. And none of them are like explored enough here for me to really latch on to it, I don't think. But the ecology stuff I was super interested in.
Okay, well, that's a good this chapter is very much about ecology. We're unfolding some of the leaf petals of the onion that is the dune's ecology. And our ecology right now in this room is that it has gotten really hot because I asked that we not use the AC. And what I propose is that we take a quick break before we get into the recap and let this room cool down a little bit, and then
I
we'll.
can handle it, but if you wanna if you can't handle it, then we can take a break.
TBH, I am wondering if we are getting cranky because it's hot in here.
Oh, no, I was
Let me
cranky.
rephrase. I'm wondering if you are getting cranky because it's hot in here.
I'm not cranky.
Okay.
No, I was cranky because I had a thing I wanted to say, and you were like, hold on, let me just keep talking about some really like insignificant stuff to get to a point that's gonna take me forever to get to.
One might argue that if you had, instead of interrupting me by telling me how boring I was being, and instead listened attentively, that I could have gotten through it even faster than I was able to. What do you think of that? You Bene Gesserit witch.
Yeah, who's getting cranky? You tell me who's getting cranky. All right. I don't know. We've been fighting too much on this podcast lately. Do you think we need to, like, reassure the listener that we, like, still love each other? I feel like sometimes we need to do that because it's like hearing your mom and dad fight.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, I just want them to know it's not about them.
We're
not going to make them choose.
In a playful way.
Yeah.
Children.
Yeah.
We still love you. That's never going to change.
Yeah.
You know, you have not come between us.
Mm-hmm.
We have come between ourselves.
Yeah. And we still love each other.
Yeah. And you're still going to see both of us. You know, you just might not see us together that much.
What? Oh my god, maybe we do need to turn the AC on.
Listen, I've got a condo on the other side of the lake. And
this is getting deeply personal for you.
Oh no, I was just thinking there was one particular you know, the sort of where Milhouse's dad goes to live whenever Milhouse's mom kicks him out, and it's like this sad divorced dad, like, apartment complex.
Yeah, like in Big Mouth too.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and yeah. I always thought that was so funny because that place in Dallas was called the Vista del Lago, and like it was whenever my friend's parents got divorced, the dad always ended up living over there.
Oh man!
And I think it just had everything that a newly divorced man thinks they want in
like
a living
what?
Situation. Number one, probably cheap.
Uh-huh.
You know, because the first thing they say is, oh, fucking, we've been spending too much on housing anyways. I'm going to go live somewhere cheap because I don't need that much. You know,
right,
and then they go in and it's like they just furnish it either hastily or shabbily. And they don't really have an idea of how things go on the wall or how to... They have no interest in really making it a home because they're not thinking about that right now. You know, and then... You go, like, your friend would invite you over because it's the weekend, you know, if they're going to have people over, it's going to have to be to their dad's apartment because that's who they're with on the weekend. And you go over there and you're like, oh, what's going on? Is that literally just a marijuana pipe right there? I'm 12. Am I sure that's what that is? But I think that's what it is. You know, and then...
Could have been a crack pipe.
Could have been. But, you know, they usually put, like, dragons and stuff on crack pipes.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You know, or like, you know, the wavy gravy color changing glass. I don't know. I've never smoked crack. I've heard it's great. I've had it recommended to me. you know, they say that it feels, and immediately upon doing it, it feels like you've won and you're a smart genius and you've accomplished something really awesome.
That sounds great.
Yeah, doesn't that sound great?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's cheap, too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's insulting to ask Whitney Houston if she's done it. We know that much.
But apparently, it's different than cocaine. You know, it's not. It's up here. You know, cocaine's like a bit more manageable and level.
Yeah. Well, so I was not even aware of that, like, concept of, like, a divorced dad condo.
Oh, I have a visceral, like, memories about it. I mean, we're talking.
But,
you know, we're talking raccoons and cat gangs fighting over macaronis in the backyard. And...
Oh, that sounds so right. Well, I was going to say, the way you described the furnishing of the apartment does remind me of a certain someone's furnishing of their apartment.
Oh, yeah, I have a visceral...
They got out of a 13-year relationship.
Yeah, no, I mean, I relate a lot to the divorced dad experience, you know, sans dad part.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
I was talking to these two people one time who had been together since, like, high school or something, and they had gotten married. They were talking about how they broke up for, like, a short period of time, and, like, the guy was like, I just, like, played video games and ate junk food for, like, a week straight, and then I was like, wait, I don't actually want this. But, like, yeah, I think it was like, this is what I want to be doing, and this is what I'm being held back from, you know?
That reminds me of, like, when I was in Korea with my ex-girlfriend, and she went on, like, a gal's, like, weekend vacation. The first thing I did was, like, I went out and I bought, like, these kind of, like, this fried noodle dish that is, you know, not healthy to eat. And then after I ate that, I ate a pizza. Like, I kind of ate that for breakfast and then ate a pizza for lunch, and by dinner time I was so sick because like my body was used to just basically eating healthier food than that. And, like, I had wrecked myself, and I had to just eat like kimchi and tofu to like kind of get level again. I had to get some like vitamins in my system.
Yeah, but I know the feeling.
But you think like, ah, the cat's away, the mice will play. Right. I don't have to, you know, I don't have to adhere to any kind of nutritional standards because, and then it turns out, oh wait, I care about that too. So,
well, and then it turns out like the cat doesn't have such terrible ideas after all.
Yeah, right.
Like maybe the cat knows what's for your own good.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's so classic cat, you know, like providing for the mice. Making sure that the mice have the right nutrition for them.
Yeah. Well, they want to get them good and fattened up so they can eat them later.
Well, but on the other hand, if they wanted to get them good and fattened up, wouldn't they just let them eat the foods that they felt most inclined to eat, which is, you know, jajangmyeon noodles and pizza?
Well, no, because that stuff is actually destroying your body internally.
Oh, they want...
And then you're not nutritionally valuable to me.
Okay, so that's kind of like... This is more like they put you on the plan, like the guy that played Mac on Always Sunny in Philadelphia went on, like, with a doctor to gain 30 pounds so that he could be fat for that one season and then also, and then lose the weight.
Right.
Yeah, which was just, like, tons of chicken breasts and, like, whole grains. But, like, you know, just 1,000 more calories of the healthy stuff than he usually ate.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's how you keep all your numbers, like, at an okay level. Because it really is a calories in, calories out equation. That's really all it is at the end of the day that determines whether you gain or lose weight.
But unless there's so much more involved in that equation.
Unless you have brown fat. This is what I learned in nutrition in college.
What the hell is brown fat?
It's like...
Is that how you make brown gravy with brown fat?
I don't know. If you're making human gravy, maybe.
I'm not ruling it out.
But yeah, I learned... I don't know if this is still like how nutritionists or like how this is understood, but there were like these studies showing that people who could eat whatever they want and stay really skinny had a higher percentage of this certain type of fat called brown fat.
As opposed to white fat?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So we have gotten to the point in the podcast where we have, we're about 5 minutes over the entirety of the podcast from last sesh, and I'd like to go ahead and get into the recap if we could.
Okay.
And I'm probably gonna have to put a disclaimer. It's like, this is a long podcast, we were really yakking it up here at this time point is where we actually start talking about
Okay. for the skippers. So what happens in this chapter, it's basically just, it's one thing that happens essentially, but it just gets like drawn out
nice and focused. And what is that one thing?
I love that about it.
What is the one thing that happens?
So Kynes, the last time...
You love when this book draws things out. That's your favorite thing about Dune is how long it is.
No. I just like when it... I felt like this chapter actually built a little, like, mystery and intrigue, you know?
Yeah. It had a cool... It had an interesting device, for sure.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
So, last time we saw Kynes, he was like, Jessica, Paul, you go in that ornithopter. I'm going in this ornithopter. Mm-hmm. We're both going to try to survive, but we can't stay together, you know.
I can't know where you went, and you can't know where I went.
Right.
It's classic guerrilla, you know, tactics.
So now that we come upon Kynes, and for reasons, as far as I can tell, unbeknownst to us, the reader, he is, like, naked, it seems like, basically.
Yes. All he has is the slashed remnants of a Jubba cape.
Right.
Or a Jubba cloak.
Yeah. So he, you know, as you may recall, dear listener, if you are to be wandering in the desert, you really need a stillsuit.
You gotta have that stillsuit.
You gotta have a stillsuit.
Because you're gonna poop and be like, look at all that, look at all that waste.
Right.
Like, that could have been on
my
thighs.
You're gonna pee and be like, I could be drinking this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so no good, no bueno that Kynes, for whatever reason, has ended up wandering through the desert. Sounds like maybe he got, like, beaten up. And his shit got stolen from him?
Oh, I'm definitely thinking he got captured and left out there.
Yeah.
Like, the Harkonnens got him, and they were like...
But then
I think he also says, like, you know, they put me out here, And if the desert doesn't get me, the sandworms will.
Well, and so it makes sense that you would assume, bless you, that it's somebody from a privileged class who has thrust this fate upon Kynes.
Uh-huh.
Because if it weren't, it would be, they'd just have taken his water, right? Like, they'd wrung him out, they would have wrung him out like a sponge.
Yeah, totally, good point. Yeah. You know, it's like they would have sponged him.
Yeah. So, basically, he's like, oh, fuck, shit, fuck, what am I going to do? So, he's like, if I could bury myself way down in the sand, then I could, like, stay cool. And while he's having these thoughts, he starts hearing his father talking to him. And he feels like his father is just, like, kind of, like, his side, just out of sight. And, like, when he tries to, like, turn to see his father,
mm-hmm.
He's like, well, why'd you move? You were just standing right there.
Yeah,
why
he
don't
can't
you
ever
want
see him.
See
it's
you.
Like he's always,
yeah.
That father is always coming from a voice like behind him or not out of his range of sight.
And he's like so annoyed because his father's just like repeating shit that he like used to tell him when he was like a little kid. Kynes
mm-hmm.
is like, I know this shit. Stop telling me shit I already know.
So what kinds of things was he repeating?
So he basically was repeating very fundamental things about the ecology of Arrakis
mm-hmm.
and like how it operates and some of the ecological principles it operates by
mm-hmm.
and what would need to happen to make such a planet more like productive ecologically, and then also like what role humans play in that, which
mm-hmm.
you know, he's basically saying like humans actually are very like play a very fundamental role in the ecology of this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And
he was also saying that like he always knew there was a missing piece to the planet's ecology, which was where's all this oxygen coming from if there's not a lot of like plant, if there's not a lot of plant mass creating the oxygen. And so he says specifically that he always knew the little makers were there even before he found them.
So he keeps saying little makers,
mm-hmm.
which, like, to me, the way that the little makers are being talked about sounds like the sandworms.
Mm-hmm. What evidence do we have about the sandworms? What's a maker?
I don't know.
Okay.
What do you mean?
Well, what's a maker hook?
Oh, well, it's a thing that you use to ride a sandworm.
Mm. That's what Kynes says in this one. He's like, I don't have any maker hooks or else I could,
mm-hmm.
you know, mount a sandworm.
Right. So that suggests to me that a maker is a sandworm.
Mm-hmm. Well, he said big maker. There's makers and there's little makers.
Oh, okay.
And he says that the little makers are down there. They're encapsulating water down there.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of like leathery little half plant, half animal things.
Mm-hmm.
He
mm-hmm.
describes them as leathery.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that they're the ones like making their, and his dad is kind of insinuating that the little makers are down there making all the oxygen,
mm-hmm.
and that's the missing piece of the biome puzzle
mm-hmm.
of where all this oxygen comes from. Why is this place even habitable to humans, like on the bare surface, without like the plant
mm-hmm.
life creating the oxygen?
Mm-hmm.
We're creating the carbon dioxide.
So is this also in the missing puzzle piece of like what the sandworms have to do with spice, I assume.
Mm-hmm. Because the other thing that's happening is you mentioned that Kynes was like, oh, I should dig down to the cooler part of the sand and bury myself, cover myself in that cooler sand.
Yep.
But he can't do that. Why?
Right.
Because he hears what?
A rumbling, which is basically like a bubble being formed beneath
mm-hmm.
the surface.
Right.
And then, I mean, like, then we get all the way to the end of this chapter. Are we ready to do that?
No. Go ahead. So he hears a bubbling underneath the surface, but he knows that he calls it a pre-spice blow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's some chemical process going on underneath him that is going to result in what he calls an explosion.
Right. Which, I mean, I don't know, like, what else. So
there is
a realization that he has along the way in this chapter, which is... sounds to me is basically like, okay, so the Fremen already know that, like, I've left them to Paul,
mm-hmm.
and so all of that's going to work itself out.
Mm-hmm.
There was some stuff going on in this chapter I didn't quite, like, understand. So.
Oh, me too. I found it interesting his dad said, like, his father is, you know, talking is talking to him, and he's annoyed at his dad, but then it's something his dad says. Yeah, and you say, like, Paul...
Something about, like,
it's about heroes. He was,
yeah,
like,
heroes, right?
Never... He says something about...
No more terrible disaster could befall your people than for them to fall into the hands of a hero.
Yeah, reading my mind, Kynes thought. Well, let him. Let him read my mind. The messages have already been sent to my Setch villages, he thought. Nothing can stop them. If the Duke's son is alive, they'll find him, talking about the Fremen, and protect him as I have commanded. They may discard the woman, his mother, but they'll save the boy. And so I read that and thinking, like, he sees a potential for Arrakis that his father had never seen, possibilities along a different path, basically along the path that Paul would lead them on. Is
mm-hmm.
Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, the question is, like, what is that quote that his father says referred to? Does it refer to Kynes as the hero or Paul as the hero? Like, is Kynes basically saying, like, I don't need to be these people's hero, like, they have Paul now? Or is he saying, like, you know, my dad thought this, but I actually think Paul's going to be, like, a good thing for them?
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting... I hadn't considered that, like, Kynes thinking of it, of himself being that hero, because he certainly set himself up as, like, the leader of all Fremen.
Right, well, and this, the one of the things his dad is talking about is, like, the intertwining of religion and law,
mm-hmm.
and he's saying, like, we need people to think that when they disobey, it's as bad as sin, which is why, like, it seems like the other races don't really understand the whole Liet thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, we can't really tell if this guy is somebody like the Fremen worship,
mm-hmm.
or if he's like their leader. And it sounds like the answer is basically both, right? Because
yeah.
there was this intentional,
mm-hmm.
Proliferation, I guess, of this like understanding of religion and law being intertwined.
Yeah, totally. And I think it was, he was saying, I read that as him saying that because of Liet's father and himself, both Kyneses, who were both planetary ecologists. Liet, or Kynes, turns out to be, you know, the son of the original ecologist or something like that. So it's like
mm-hmm.
a family business.
Right.
But the dad said, the masses of Arrakis will know that we work to make the land flow with water, his father said. Most of them, of course, will have only a semi-mystical understanding of how we intend to do this. Many, not understanding the prohibitive mass ratio problem, may even think that we'll bring water from some other planet rich in it. Let them think anything they wish, as long as they believe us. And that's... Believe in us. And so I was thinking, like, he's saying religion and law are going to be the same under this, because that's the only way we can keep these fuckers from not wasting water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
mm-hmm.
taking this long-term terraforming approach. Like,
mm-hmm.
you can't... You have to have a religious significance, because, like, if it was just you and me,
mm-hmm.
and somebody came along and said, listen, you have to bust your ass and live in caves and do all of this crazy shit so that 4,000 years from now,
mm-hmm.
there will be water flowing on the surface of this planet. Does that sound like the kind of thing you want to devote your life to? Is 4,000 years from now there being water on this planet?
No.
Right, because it's, you know, like, who gives a shit? But if you have a religious view of that...
Right. Which makes me wonder about, like, sacred cows, you know? Like, is
mm-hmm.
there some kind of, like, ecological foundation? I really don't know enough about it to say one way or the other, but...
You're talking about literal sacred cows?
Yeah, literal sacred cows.
Mm.
But other things, like, you know, that... I mean, there's certainly, you know, we know that, like, native and indigenous populations have ascribed a lot of, like, religious significance to nature, right? So... This is not an unheard of concept.
Mm-hmm.
Funny
stuff. We really knocked it out of the park in the comedy area tonight. But, and I think that's what Liet was doing. Like, that's why they were, you know, they whispered about him in fucking, you know, tones like he's a god. And the Atreides couldn't figure out if this was a god they were worshiping or a
right.
guy or,
right, right.
or what.
Yep.
Yeah,
so basically what happens in the end of this chapter, if
meanwhile,
I may...
Meanwhile, there's hawks going as he's, like, thinking
yeah,
about all
and
this.
The hawks,
hawks
then the hawks, like, get scared off, and Kynes realizes it's because this bubble's about to burst. And it sounds to me like basically what happens is he's like right on top of this bubble burst, which explodes and forms some kind of whirlpool that sucks him back down into the sand, which I guess is his death. And but then he's like, well, at least my water's, I don't know, I forgot.
And as the whirlpool crashed down, he thought, well, isn't this nice?
Yeah. And then as this planet killed him, it occurred to Kynes that his father and all the other scientists were wrong, that the most persistent principles of the universe were accident and error.
Even the Hawks could appreciate these facts.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? The most persistent principle of the universe is accident and error. I believe that. I fuck up way more than I succeed.
Totally. Well, and I think that there are other ways to say that, too, you know.
Oh, yeah?
Lay
it on me.
Well, like, yeah, you know, like, going back to Parable of the Sower, actually, like, that one of the, like, main things from that book is, like...
Oh, yeah, they worship change?
Change, exactly, right. So, it's kind of this idea that, like, you're... Nothing's gonna be perfect and nothing's gonna be static, and like the only way you're gonna like figure shit out is to just fuck with it.
And change is constant, and you know you don't want to be the person that's asking who moved my cheese. You need to move with the cheese,
right? So there, this isn't a new principle in the canon of the world, right? So, but I think it's an important lesson at the same time, as it's just like, you know, and we've talked about several kind of like platitudes coming out of this book, right? But it's just, it's like one of those where it's like fucking up isn't bad necessarily. No. It's like an important part of the equation.
Yeah. You fuck up until you get it right.
Right. Exactly.
You fuck up all the way toward success.
Right. Exactly. And I assume that there has been a lot of fucking up as these, like, planetologists have tried to understand this ecosystem
as well. You want to see God laugh? Make a plan.
Right. Make a planetologist.
Whoa! Oh,
there's your comedy.
All right.
End there.
And we're done. Okay, love you, bye.
Okay, love you, bye.